Next case is 04-247, in re S.J. Minor versus Sonia Jones. Mr. Epgar.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. John Epgar from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the state of Ohio. And as the appellant in this case, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. In accepting jurisdiction over this case, this court specifically directed the parties to brief and discuss two specific propositions of law. One, when a notice of appeal has been filed, does the juvenile court have jurisdiction to go ahead and proceed with an adjudication once that notice, after the notice of appeal has been filed? And secondly, does the double jeopardy clause of the U.S. and Ohio Constitution prohibit the Court of Appeals from ordering a juvenile to be tried as an adult if the juvenile court refused to bind the juvenile over and indeed found the juvenile delinquent? With respect to these propositions of law, the state argues that once the notice of appeal is filed, that divests the juvenile court jurisdiction, and any action taken by the juvenile court after the notice of appeal has been filed is null and void. Secondly, because that adjudication was null and void, we feel the double jeopardy clause does not prohibit the Court of Appeals from ordering or resolving the issues and potentially ordering this juvenile to be tried as an adult.
Do we know from the record why the prosecutor dismissed it or did not request a discretionary bind over?
At the time, there was a request for a discretionary bind over. As policy in these cases, my office and the juvenile division will routinely request a discretionary, even in a mandatory situation. In this case, the court held a hearing on the mandatory bind over, and once it became apparent that the court wasn't going to, and in fact, journalize their decision not binding it over, the state withdrew the discretionary bind over. The purpose of the withdrawal was to clarify and allow us to appeal at that time so the state could appeal and pursue its argument with the Court of Appeals.
Well, you took a risk, obviously.
I understand that.
We would hold for you, or that we would agree with you that, but there was really not a final order, was there? I mean, why? The trial court still had the discretion to bind over the minor.
But indeed, there was no request at that point. In the point of time on the morning of November 20th, after they had denied the mandatory bind over and our notice of appeal was filed and our discretionary bind over was withdrawn, at that precise moment in time, there was no request for a discretionary bind over pending. We hadn't asked, the request wasn't pending, it had been dismissed. So at that point, all there was before the court was whether or not the juvenile was subject to the mandatory bind over positions of 29-51-12. And so in that situation, given the fact that there was no discretionary bind over requested, and we had appealed the mandatory bind over, I would submit that absolutely that's a final appealable order, and the state has to be allowed to appeal for that precisely because of double jeopardy.
The dismissal of those other charges also amounted to a final appealable order.
Absolutely, and what I want to make clear for the court is that there was two main things that happened with the journal entry of the juvenile judge on November 19th. There were two counts charging this juvenile in juvenile court. The first one was straight murder. The second one was felony murder under 29-0302B, or acts that would constitute murder if an adult. In the journal entry November 19th, the court dismissed altogether the first count, the murder charge, and reduced the second count from felony murder to voluntary manslaughter. Then, because it was a voluntary manslaughter, the court did not bind the juvenile order over pursuant to the mandatory bind over. So in addition to an appeal of the refusal to bind over under the mandatory bind over, the state also appealed the dismissal of count one. So as the Justice Resnick accurately pointed out, there was an appeal of that and also appeal of the bind over.
The defendant argues, as you know, that that looks like a final appealable order, except that if the trial court had decided in a discretionary bind over proceeding to bind over the juvenile here, that the fact that the trial judge dismissed a couple of counts has no bearing in the adult court, in the general division. Is that accurate? Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with their point that once a juvenile is bound over, then the state could go to the grand jury and charge whatever may be appropriate. But in this case, I would reference 29-4567, which specifically allows the state to appeal a decision dismissing all or part of the indictment in a juvenile delinquency case. So it's an interesting proposition that this case presents the court, in that with the dismissal of count one, the state argues we have a direct and immediate appeals of right for the dismissal of that complaint under 29-4567. Also, we have an appeal from the denial of the mandatory bindover, which is why, in effect, we took an appeal of right, and we also filed a motion for leave to appeal to ensure that the jurisdiction was properly transferred to the Court of Appeals. Indeed, the Court of Appeals did accept jurisdiction and briefed the issue, but then a week before the oral argument dismissed it on the double jeopardy grounds.
When I look at the Court of Appeals decision, I don't see them addressing the appeal of the murder issue. They just seem to talk about the bindover.
Absolutely. And to understand, to give some context to explain that, Justice Stratton, when we briefed the issue in the Court of Appeals, one of our assignments of error dealt with mandatory bindover, one was dealt with the dismissal of that count. The issue whether or not double jeopardy applied was not raised. The juvenile filed the motion to dismiss and argued waiver, didn't really argue it as a double jeopardy claim. So double jeopardy, it appeared to the state, wasn't even being discussed at that time. It wasn't briefed. The Court of Appeals raised it on its own, sua sponte, saying, hey, this whole thing's gone because of double jeopardy. And what I noted in the Court of Appeals' opinion is Judge Celebrezze never mentions the fact that we had appealed it, that we had filed a notice of appeal prior to the adjudication. He hung his hat and his opinion on the adjudication, never mentions the fact that we filed the notice of appeal prior to the adjudication. We filed motions for reconsideration and argued that.
And he doesn't mention the right of appeal of the dismissal at all.
No.
He just seems to ignore that. And clearly the statute gave you the right to appeal that.
Absolutely. And like I said, in our brief, these issues weren't discussed because, frankly, they weren't raised. And in our briefs on our motions for reconsideration, that's where we talked about the fact, and the state brought up the notice of appeal that was filed and our position that jurisdiction had been transferred the moment that our notice of appeal was filed. As the juvenile agrees, the filing of a notice of appeal generally is a jurisdictional event that precludes what happens after.
Even if we were to agree that the filing, that the mandatory bindover decision was not appealable, once you filed the appeal on the dismissal of the murder charge, that divested the court of any ability to go forward, because going forward was sort of meaningless if you didn't know whether you could go forward on the murder charge.
Absolutely. And it's precisely because of double jeopardy that the state's position is that we have to be allowed to appeal the situation. If we weren't able to appeal, we would have precisely the problem that the Court of Appeals mentioned. If we weren't able to appeal or did not appeal, we'd have a juvenile who would be admitted and validly admitting and being adjudicated delinquent, and double jeopardy would absolutely preclude us from going forward.
If you had won, if the Court of Appeals had considered your second prong, the dismissal of the murder charge, and had agreed that dismissal was improper, then you're back to having an automatic mandatory bindover, are you not?
Absolutely. I mean, we feel that, you know, it's not an issue that's part of the propositions of law before this court, but what we had argued before the 8th District that they never got to was the fact that the court exceeded its authority, exceeded the scope of mandatory bindover, and we disagreed with the juvenile judge decision.
So isn't the mandatory bindover just sort of really a secondary issue? Because if you won on your statutorily allowed appeal of challenging the dismissal, and you won that appeal, you automatically got the bindover back in play, do you not?
I agree, it would.
So it doesn't really matter whether you can appeal the bindover or not. The key issue is whether you can appeal the dismissal, which the statute seems pretty clear on, and I'll ask your counsel why that should not be allowed, because the statute seems pretty clear it is.
And the problem, or the reason why these are tied together so much, is because it was within the same journal entry that the court does both actions, or and indeed all three actions, dismissing count one, knocking down count two, and refusing to bind over the juvenile under that. And
where in the record does the withdrawal by the state of its request appear?
We cited in our brief, we don't dispute that it was withdrawn. It was on each one of the transcripts from juvenile court is dated November 20th. I seem to think it was on page 6, maybe. It was right at the time this all...
That was done orally in court, am I right?
Orally in court, correct. Okay. And the timing, I think, is maybe not dispositive, but significant. It was apparent to us that the judge was going to do this. She was going to deny the mandatory bindover. We could not appeal until the court doesn't speak. It speaks only through its journal entry. We couldn't appeal until she issued that journal entry. So we waited, and it wasn't until 6:30 on November 19th that she issued the journal entry. The next morning, or 6:30 on the 19th, she issued the journal entry. At 9 o'clock the next morning, we had filed that notice of appeal, and we had indicated right then we served it on counsel, told the court we had filed the notice of appeal, and further then dismissed the discretionary bindover.
And you must have been convinced too that she would have not ruled in your favor on discretionary bindover. Is that right?
Well, I mean, it's not in the record, but
law here. My concern is that this case, this part of it, seems very factually. It seems you made a judgment. Either you weren't prepared, or you made a judgment. The trial court's going to rule against it. So we're going to dismiss another procedure that we had to, under the statute, to attempt to have the juvenile bound over. What's your response? I mean, was it really the fact that you wanted to appeal it, or were you just not prepared? It was the day before.
Yeah.
You dismissed the day before the hearing, and does the record show that? I don't want you to...
No, it was everything together. I mean, first of all, they did want to clarify the issue. My office felt strongly about the mandatory bindover issue. And as a side, we're not unsympathetic to the mitigation evidence that Ms. Jones has to offer, and we feel that would be relevant in the court, or in the trial court. But in this situation, you know, we felt strongly about the mandatory bindover issue, and so we wanted to clarify that issue, that we could appeal it. But also, and frankly, you're right, Your Honor, it was apparent to us after the way the mandatory bindover hearing went, we weren't very optimistic about this judge doing a discretionary bindover. But I mean, that's not the record. I mean, you know, it's just a response.
What do you mean when you say we're sympathetic to her evidence, but I don't understand what you mean.
No, I misspoke. We're not, the point is, I'm not saying, because we opposed the bringing in of the mitigation evidence that the juvenile offered at the mandatory bindover. What I'm saying is, the state isn't saying that issues aren't relevant. What I'm saying is that stuff would be relevant in the adult court once it's transferred. I don't think it was relevant at the mandatory bindover hearing. That's what our appeal, at the substance
well,
of our
might
appeal.
Might it be relevant for the judge to determine that you've overcharged?
I would submit that it's relevant in terms of, at the mandatory bindover, the issue is what the age of the child, there's no dispute she was 17, and whether there's probable cause that she...
Does the juvenile judge have no authority to look and see whether or not this really is the murder charge that you've brought in the bindover proceedings?
I would submit, obviously, under this court's opinion, Iacona, she has to look at whether there's probable cause for each element of the offense to do the mandatory bindover. Our argument, and if we're successful here, we would pursue the argument, as we already have in the 8th District, is that by the evidence of the juvenile's state of mind was more in the nature of a self-defense that doesn't that may not negate the element. I'm saying it's not relevant at the probable cause determination.
Well, it appears to me that you're concentrating, and the court is also concentrating on the mandatory bindover, but I mean, it's really clear in 2945-67 that the prosecution has an immediate right of appeal when a charge is dismissed by a court.
Yes.
So isn't that your, you should be focusing upon that, and that's the reason that, that you had a right to appeal, and the Court of Appeals totally ignored that?
Absolutely, that's my argument. And in responding to it, I want to respond to the court's question, and also the primary argument in defendant's brief is there, and I would argue combining of the discretionary bind over mandatory bind over issue, and arguing that they're premature, that we were premature. There doesn't seem to be much of an argument against the 294567. That's not to say that I don't feel that's our lead argument as to how our appeal, why we had an appeal of right, and why that was a valid notice of appeal, and why it defested the juvenile court of jurisdiction, and the subsequent admission and adjudication was null and void.
Counsel, I just need to understand the filing of the mandatory bindover and the discretionary bindover at the same time. Is that a policy of your office, the belt and suspenders approach here?
We had done that in this case, and there was a specific request for a discretionary bindover. You know, discretionary implies that we asked for it, and the mandatory is by operation of law. So we had asked for a discretionary bindover, and we had also indicated to the court that we had felt that the mandatory bindover provision applied, and also we'd ask for the discretionary bindover.
But you do this as a matter of course, as alternatives in most cases?
In you know, every case is different, but yes, they do that in a lot of cases, and that was what happened initially. But when, as this case developed, we felt that it was the mandatory bindover issue was clear, and we wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Epker. Mr. Ingersoll.
Good morning, Your Honors. Never argued in this building. I wanted to start first, because I could do this very quickly, just to answer Justice O'Donnell's question. The motion, the state's oral motion for the to withdraw the discretionary bindover is at page 5 of the November 20th, 2002 hearing. That motion was granted at page 13 of the same hearing.
Thank you.
To address, then, however, the question which seems to be of most concern to the judges, justices that are on my left-hand side. we maintain in this, and because of the unique factual situation of this case, the state, in fact, did not have a right of immediate appeal from the ruling to dismiss count one, because the state did not lack a remedy. The reason a state can take an immediate appeal from a decision to dismiss a count under ordinary circumstances is because the state has no remedy. In a juvenile case, if the judge decides I'm dismissing count one and they proceed to the delinquency hearing, the state would then have no remedy ever to appeal the decision on count one. The same way in an adult case, in a criminal case, if the court dismisses a count and the case goes to trial, the state, because of the double jeopardy provisions of the Constitution, would never have the ability to appeal that decision. That is not, however, the case in this particular set of facts. In this case, had the state waited to determine if there was, for the court to make a ruling on the amenability hearing, it could have done one of two things. If, as Justice Pfeiffer points out, if the state had won on the amenability hearing.
But does the statute require that? The statute doesn't say, if you do this and this and this, you don't have an immediate right of appeal. It just says, count dismissed, immediate right of appeal. It doesn't have any qualifiers on it. Are you requiring us to read qualifiers in?
The statute also does not say an immediate right of appeal. The statute says it has a right to an appeal. The question really becomes, when can the state exercise that right of appeal? In this case, we maintain the state also exercised that right of appeal prematurely because the court had not fully rendered its full decision. And because the state had a remedy.
If the court had dismissed the charge, then you had gone forward with the amenability hearing and the court denied that.
Correct.
Then don't you have double jeopardy now?
No, because under the Hunter case that is cited in our brief, if any appeals court rules that the trial court ruled incorrectly on either on the amenability hearing or the probable cause hearing, jeopardy has not attached. The reason being that while you have a bindover proceeding in effect, the question of the trial court's or the juvenile court's jurisdiction is the very question to be decided.
Counsel, when you have the amenability hearing and you've dismissed count one, what is under consideration at that point?
It would be whether Sonia Jones was amenable under count two and the involuntary manslaughter to be tried in the juvenile court system.
I understand that. So what you're saying is it's irrelevant that the count one, the more serious count, was off the table permanently?
No, I'm not saying it's irrelevant. I'm saying the state had, no matter how the court ruled at the amenability hearing, the state did have a remedy. It did not need to take its appeal at that time.
If the state would have proceeded,
yes,
and just forgot about the fact that the count was dismissed, and allowed the juvenile court judge to proceed with what they wanted to proceed with, certainly double jeopardy would have applied.
No, Your Honor. As the Hunter case cited in our brief points out, when you have a bind-over proceeding going forward, the very question that the juvenile court must decide is its jurisdiction to proceed. If a court of appeals, as happened in the Hunter case, rules that there was an error in that bind-over proceeding, it said the juvenile court never had jurisdiction to rule on the case because the question of whether it should have gone to the adult court had not been properly decided. In that case, in the Hunter case, they sent the matter, even though Terry Hunter had gone to trial and been found delinquent, they actually sent the case back to the juvenile court and said, you must first rule on whether or not there was a proper bind over. And until you do that, you had no jurisdiction to rule on the delinquency. The same would be true here. If the state had taken...
That wasn't my point. I'm saying that if the prosecution allowed the juvenile judge to rule on both the mandatory bind over and the discretionary bind over, and if the juvenile judge did rule on that, I don't see how the prosecution could appeal from a final judgment.
Why would the state not be able to appeal? If the trial court decides it's not going to bind over, that's a final appealable order, as the Klein case points out, and I do not dispute that point. The state could then appeal that decision, and it could appeal everything that was done in that hearing. It could appeal the dismissal of count one. It could appeal the evidentiary rulings that the trial court, the juvenile court, made.
And the Court of Appeals probably would have ruled the same and said a double jeopardy attached. The dismissal is very much the count that was dismissed is very much a part of the consideration of whether this juvenile should be bound over. And if the prosecution doesn't have a right to an immediate appeal of that dismissal of that count, I would think they're, lost.
Again,
forever.
I must respectfully disagree, Your Honor. It is not a question of an immediate appeal. It is a question of, does the state have a remedy? The state would have a remedy even if it allowed the amendability hearing to go forward, because it could appeal that, and until the amendability hearing or the full bind-over hearing is properly decided, the juvenile court actually would have no jurisdiction to proceed. The reason in this case why the juvenile court had jurisdiction to proceed is not because of the appeal. It is because the state withdrew its bind-over request. Once the state withdrew its bind-over request, the juvenile court had full jurisdiction to go forward.
Once they filed their appeal, because there's no qualification, I just looked the statute up, there's no qualification on immediate or non-immediate, once they filed their appeal, the law is clear that that divests a juvenile court of the right to go forward. It doesn't put any qualifiers on it. It just says once you file your appeal, juvenile court has to shut down.
I understand that, Your Honor, but the appeal should be filed at the appropriate time when you have all of the issues in play.
So you're saying it was not a final appealable order at the time that the count one was dismissed and the mandatory bind-over was rejected by the juvenile court, even though there was a notice of appeal. You think that the prosecution was obligated to proceed with filing and acting upon a discretionary bind-over request?
I believe that the state needed to wait to see. Yes, we needed to wait to see what the court was going to do in the bind-over proceeding.
But what happens?
Found a decision.
But the notice of appeal took the right of the court to proceed away.
Not if the notice of appeal is filed prematurely. A premature notice of appeal is a void order.
Your argument simply is that yes, if a notice of appeal is filed from a final appealable order, that means the jurisdiction of the trial court ceases, but it has to be a final appeal order, and that's the issue here.
That is correct. We maintain this was not a
final appeal order. It was interlocutory. That's the issue.
That is correct.
We know that when an appeal is filed, that terminates the jurisdiction of the trial court, but the appeal has to be a legitimate appeal. And that's your argument.
See, that is correct, Your Honor. If I haven't been expressing that properly, I do apologize.
Is that also your argument? I'm trying to get to the simplify the issue here. Isn't that also your argument in response to point 67? Is that yes, the state has a right to appeal the dismissal of a charge against the juvenile, but the state has to wait until all of the remedies at the juvenile court have been exhausted, which means the discretionary hearing.
Under the unique factual pattern of this procedure, yes, Your Honor.
So we're forced to decide here whether the prosecutor erred, I guess, by dismissing its request for a discretionary bindover hearing.
Erred in doing that, and also erred in filing its notice of appeal prematurely.
Well, yeah, but that just simply means interlocutory appeal versus
right.
The final appeal order, and so that.
We're going to have to look at 29-4567, the language of the statute, and see if in any way it implicates or discusses the final appealable order issue.
As
it's
stated,
the two entwined. I mean, does the fact that the statute gives the state the right to appeal as a matter of right without any limitations on time, whether that in any way suggests that there is that makes it a final appealable order when the juvenile judge acts in the fashion that she did in this case?
Your Honor, although not exactly analogous, but for example, in the case of a suppression motion, if a defendant files a suppression motion and loses at trial, the defendant has a right to appeal that decision, but cannot take an immediate appeal from that decision. It must wait for the trial to go forward, because if the defendant is found not guilty, there doesn't need to be an appeal. In the same way, if the state had waited and Ms. Jones had been bound over, the state wouldn't have needed to take an appeal, because it could have gone to the grand jury and gotten an indictment on both counts of murder against Ms. Jones.
But the prosecution doesn't have to wait. If a suppression hearing is granted that they can certify eviscerates their case, they don't have to wait. They have an immediate right of appeal.
But that is because, Your Honor, a motion to suppress, if they lose a motion to suppress, they cannot go forward, because they at that point would have no remedy.
And if your count's dismissed, they can't go forward on the murder count.
No, I maintain they can go forward in that case had they sought the notice of appeal after the amenability hearing was over.
Why should they go through the exercise? Why should they go through a futile exercise of a discretionary hearing if they have an immediate right of appeal, and the appellate court says you should not have dismissed it, reinstate the murder count, mandatory bindover, no hearing necessary? It's like you're requiring an extra hearing to get to something that you could avoid by the procedure the statute gives them.
Because first of all, we don't know that it's a futile right to appeal, and second of all, we don't even know whether an appeal would have been necessary. Had Ms. Jones been bound over after the amenability hearing, the state would never have had to take an appeal at all, because they could have gone back and gotten indictments.
And if the trial judge was wrong in dismissing the murder count, they don't have to go back and get an indictment either. The appeal decides that issue too.
But the question, it still becomes a question of when does the final appeal order attach? We maintain under the specific facts of this case, we're not saying that in all cases a ruling to dismiss a count is not a final appealable order. Certainly it would be in a case where you don't have other facts in play. And because of the unique factual situation of this case, with other procedural rules and hearings coming into play, we maintain that the state did in this case file a premature notice of appeal, because it does not yet have a final appealable order.
The trial court in a discretionary bindover proceeding considers different facts or matters than it does in the mandatory hearing. Is that right, or am I wrong?
Well, at the juncture that this case was in, actually the trial court would no longer be considering the probable cause aspects.
Well, I mean just under the statute, under the law, does it in practice, let's not take this case, but generally, is there some reason for a trial court to hold an amenability hearing even though it has overruled the motion for a mandatory bind over?
In this case, yes, because the trial court said, I do not find probable cause under a Class 1 felony. I do find probable cause under a Class 2 felony. We must have an amenability hearing in order to see whether or not the state's discretionary bind over will be granted. So in this situation, yes, there was matters for the trial court to decide at the amenability hearing. It could, as I've maintained, have bound Ms. Jones over, and then the state would never have had to take its appeal.
But you just told us that was withdrawn by the state at that time, and there was nothing then before the court.
But it was withdrawn by the state, Your Honor, after the state filed its notice of appeal and after the trial court was prepared to go forward.
Well, the point then would be, the appeal is pending in the court, and there's nothing before the trial court because the state dismissed it.
Again, under the specific facts of this case, yes. But that's the state's error. The state is asking this court
Tell me what you mean by that was the state's error.
It was the state's decision to withdraw the bind-over request. Ms. Jones never said withdraw the bind-over.
If it was withdrawn, and if the other matter had been pending in the Court of Appeals, what was before the trial court?
At that point, what was before the trial court?
At the point when the notice of appeal is pending in the Court of Appeals, and at that point when the state has withdrawn, what was then pending before the trial court?
As we maintained that the notice of appeal was filed prematurely, what was pending before the trial court was the actual delinquency proceedings, which occurred when Ms. Jones admitted.
But nothing pending before the juvenile court on the bindover issue.
After the state withdrew, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
That is why we maintain that the state erred. The state, in essence, threw the legal equivalent here of a temper tantrum, and is asking this court now to press a reset button to correct its own mistake. This court does not need to correct the state's mistakes.
Isn't your argument, I hate to make your argument for you, but isn't your argument that right, there was nothing pending before the trial court because there was an appeal, but your argument has to be that there was an interlocutory appeal because at the amenability hearing there would be something else. It's like finding someone guilty and then later having the sentencing hearing. It's not over yet.
Well,
isn't that you don't argue that, but I'm trying to figure out what the issue is here.
Under the facts of this case, as we maintain, this is an interlocutory appeal, thus the notice of appeal was void and did not deprive the juvenile court of jurisdiction. That's point one.
Let's go through it. It's an interlocutory appeal. Why?
Because at this point, Your Honor, the trial court had not made any decision on whether it would bind Ms. Jones over. And before it did that, the state was not without remedies. And in fact, the state, if Ms. Jones had been bound over, the state could secured all the murder indictments.
Did the juvenile court have the right to make that decision?
That it found no probable cause? Yes. That's what the juvenile court can do in a probable cause
hearing.
Wouldn't
that be up to the Court of Appeals to decide whether the notice of appeal is prematurely filed? How can a juvenile judge decide an appellate issue?
We didn't ask the juvenile court to decide an appellate issue, Your Honor.
Well, there was a notice of appeal pending. Whether it was proper or improper, I don't see how a juvenile court judge can ignore that until the Court of Appeals speaks to it. I don't see where the juvenile court had anything at that point before it to proceed with when there's a notice of appeal pending.
The juvenile court agreed, actually did make a ruling that it felt that the notice of appeal was premature and thus did not stay it from its course of action. Then when the state withdrew its request for a bindover, the juvenile court, because it felt that the notice of appeal was void, had full jurisdiction to proceed to the adjudication proceedings.
What would happen if the state had only filed for mandatory bindover, no discretionary, the judge had dismissed the murder charge? Do they have a right to appeal then, or are they obligated under your theory to now file a discretionary bindover?
No, because actually in this case what happened is the trial court also said, this case is converted into a discretionary bindover because I have found probable cause for a Class 2 felony.
How is that different from them then dismissing it? In either scenario, you don't have a bindover discretionary pending anymore before the juvenile court. Whether they didn't file it in the first place or whether they dismiss it, it's gone.
No, it is not gone, Your Honor, because, again, if the state had prevailed in the discretionary bindover and Ms. Jones was bound over, then it could have sought indictments overall under all counts. If the state had lost, it could have appealed everything, every ruling of the bindover proceeding, from those that went from the probable cause hearing all the way down to the amendability hearing. And it could have appealed the dismissal of count one, and it could have appealed the evidentiary rulings, and it could have appealed the reduction of count two, and it could have appealed the decision not to find amendability.
Counsel, did I just hear you say that the juvenile court, upon ruling that the mandatory bindover was inappropriate, converted this to a discretionary bindover, even though there was a notice of appeal and a dismissal of the discretionary bindover request? That's what the court did?
No, the trial court never dismissed the mandatory bindover request.
It ruled on the mandatory bindover request.
No, it ruled that it found no probable cause to any Class 1 felony and
by
said,
dismissing count 1.
And reducing count 2, and then said we will have an amendability hearing because I have found probable cause as to a Class 2 felony. It never dismissed the bindover proceeding, Your Honor.
Well, the prosecutor dismissed the bindover, and you're saying, sua sponte, the court's doing their own discretionary bindover, requesting it and ruling on it and proceeding with it.
What I said, Your Honor, what I said was that the court said, because I have found probable cause as to a Class 1 felony, and there was a bindover
request.
Class 2 felony, excuse me. And that there was a bindover request before me, we will proceed to an amendability hearing.
Okay, that's not exactly what you said. To a discretionary.
I apologize if I worded it inarticulately, inexplicably.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ebker, you've used your time, but we've taken Mr. Ingersoll well over his, so you may have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. Briefly, juvenile has argued that they've brought up the cases where they have to wait till after a case is over before they can appeal. It's precisely because of double jeopardy why we have to be able to appeal before the adjudication so that double jeopardy doesn't attach. The Hunter case he cites is a case from 1984 from the Court of Appeals that doesn't even discuss double jeopardy. It's apparent to me their argument is that our notice of appeal was premature. If we waited until after the adjudication, if the Court of Appeals dismissed our appeal when we filed notice of appeal before the adjudication, I'm sure they would have dismissed our appeal if we would have done it after the adjudication. And absolutely, Judge O'Donnell is exactly right, Justice O'Donnell. At the time this all happened, there was no discretionary bindover request pending. The court doesn't bind over on discretionary bindovers on their own. It's pursuant to the state's request. At that point in time when our notice of appeal was filed, there was no request for a discretionary bindover. Therefore, all that's before the court was once the mandatory bindover decision was done, there's no discretionary bindover. The decision is the adjudication.
What happens here with the second charge, the involuntary manslaughter, I guess it is, or voluntary manslaughter, what happens to that on the amenability issue?
If there were a discretionary bindover request, there would be an amenability determination, and the court would have before it whether or not to transfer the juvenile to adult court if the state was seeking a discretionary bindover request on that charge, because once it's reduced to manslaughter, it's no longer subject to the mandatory bindover position. And then they go through all the statutory and juvenile rule 30 determinations for amenability. But that was not requested by the state at that point in time. It was specifically withdrawn. That wasn't before the court. Either they were allowed to appeal or they would go straight to the adjudication, which is what they did. And if we're not allowed to appeal, then the double jeopardy would be implicated and bar any further prosecution.
So the amenability issues that the juvenile judge was looking at on the voluntary manslaughter was more in the nature of the sentencing decision rather than whether to send the case over to
Sure. The
Common Pleas Court.
Absolutely.
Division.
Absolutely. And at that point, it wasn't just a sentencing that would have, or a sentencing type that was left, but then at the point when we filed our notice of appeal, the juvenile hadn't been adjudicated yet. There was no admission and no finding that her actions constituted the crime that was charged. So at that point, there had not been an adjudication when we had filed our notice of appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you. We would ask this, that the 8th District be reversed, that the judgment of the 8th District be reversed, and the matter be set to proceed with our appeal in the 8th District. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Epker. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.